expectation is an entitlement. When you ask them their opinions about national health care, you get all kinds of murky information. So keep that in mind. The next point I want to dwell on just for a minute is a problem that I find those of us in higher education have in presenting our research results. We are, all of us, tied to academic research. Our institutions do it. And we know that academic research has to be statistically pure and it has to be replicable someplace else. If I do a study in New Hampshire, you have to be able to do one in Oregon, which exactly replicates it to prove or disprove my results. Because of this academic research model, we have to understand how to present the difference between that kind of formal research and the informal research, which is all we can generally afford in most public relations contexts. Fortunately, some of those who specialize in research have given us some of the answers. The probability sample, which is the base of all statistical research, are only needed, we must remember, and we must continue to remind our managements when presenting our research, are only needed to survey an unknown universe. So if you are going after an unknown out there, an unknown universe, of course you have to have a statistically pure probability sample. But in public relations, do we ever have an unknown universe? I have yet to meet a research problem that had an unknown universe. In fact, I am generally dealing, as I'm sure you are, with very well-known universes, very well-known publics. What I need to know is what they are going to do, how they will respond to a certain program or a certain issue. And for that kind of research, according to one of the leading experts in this field, it's our knowledge which is more important than the purity of the statistics. I think, however, that this academic model has misled us and probably is a bias that the research we present to our managements will encounter. Therefore, I just want to warn you of that and urge you to have your answers ready. A couple of other types of research that I find very useful, a couple of other uses for what we've been talking about. First is the Delphi process. One of the difficulties on this list that I gave you back here, that the university communities in general seem to be highly resistant to long-range planning. How many of you have a long-range plan in your university which is not a motherhood statement? Well, I mean, it doesn't say, you know, we're going to better the conditions of mankind by educating all the so-and-so, you know what I mean. How many of you have one that says we're going to do specific kind of accountable things in a certain period of time? That's good. I'm glad that many of you do. A lot of the work that we are asked to do for institutions of higher education is to prepare the climate for some kind of an accountable long-range plan. I think that's probably the key word, is that higher education, many segments of it, have resisted accountability. There is, however, a method which I find helps do long-range planning in the campus community without having the usual pitfalls, and it's the Delphi process. What the Delphi process is a way of having a meeting where people can disagree like mad and have these verbal fistfights without actually getting in the same room where they can reach each other. It's kind of a neat trick. The Delphi process, if you're not familiar with it, I'll just give you a zip through it, but I would urge you to look it up when you get home. As a way to forecast how people will respond to an activity like planning or to plans that are already made, it is unparalleled. The Delphi process first circulates a set of questions or a set of assumptions to a group of about 30 to 35 people who are knowledgeable. In other words, in your campus community, if you're doing a long-range plan, you'd want to circulate the Delphi to the top administrators, the deans, a certain number of faculty, some staff people, possibly students, depending on the scope of the planning. They respond individually, you see,
in the quiet of their own offices or homes to that set of questions. Those are then compiled, completely anonymously, of course, and the results of the consensus or lack thereof, which comes back from the first set of questions, is then circulated again. And this time, instead of saying, how do you feel about enlarging the adult learner segment of our institution? This time, the question will say that 18 of the 22 people who answered greatly favor enlarging the adult learner segment. Can you agree with this opinion? In other words, you're asking those who said no before to tell you whether they're willing to join the majority, to make any consensus. If the answers come back this time that most everybody can agree with that opinion, you have a pretty good indicator that, properly presented and phrased, you will be able to reach consensus on that. If you keep getting back split answers, 13 to 16, 17 to 20, you know that that's the problem area, and it may be wisdom to drop that section of the plan in order to get the rest of the plan in place. We've never had a technique like that before. Sometimes Delphi's run 4 and 5 rounds of distribution to the same list, and we have found them very, very effective for one of the most difficult missing ingredients, in my opinion, in the public relations and indeed the administration of higher education. Another type of research that we are finding increasingly useful is sociometric research. I guess we all know by now that opinion leaders are the folks who increasingly carry our mass society. The bigger society gets, the more vocal everybody gets, including Joe and Jane Sixpack. But Joe and Jane Sixpack rarely take part when decisions are really being made. And I know that's an undemocratic statement, but it's a purely historical, well-documented position. Therefore, as public relations professionals, whether we're raising money, dealing with alumni, or whatever, surely we know that it's the opinion leaders that we have to reach. But the question always is, who really are the opinion leaders? For a long time, in fact, until about only 12 years ago, the sociologists were telling us that the opinion leaders in American society were those people who had reached a publicly visible position of leadership. The lawyer, the minister, the school superintendent, the bank president. Since that time, of course, as our society has changed, opinion leaders now exist in every group, at every social, economic, and educational level. And therefore, we no longer can tell who the opinion leaders are without doing some research. In case you're dubious about this, let me just present you the guiding principle. Much of our work in our firm involves changing the world. We do indeed deal in attitude, and we hope behavioral change on social and organizational issues. And so every day we're in the middle of a crisis, a headline. That's where we live. And so we have to be terribly sensitive to how can we help our institutions to be persuasive and prevail in those kind of circumstances. And this is what we're finding increasingly, and why opinion leaders are so terribly important. Any subject, any issue, if you draw a line like this, and this represents the continuum of response, of opinion, attitude, behavior on that issue. On any issue, you can take a small segment at either end that are the zealots. Generally, that runs about 5% at either end of the spectrum. Zealots, of course, are fascinating people, and we all love them, especially when they're zealots in our cause. The trouble is, in public relations terms, zealots turn people off. So the strategy is clear, and that is to get your own zealots to shut up and go on vacation and try and get the other side's zealots to be very vocal. It's one of the greater skills I think we'll develop during the 80s. You've got about 10% of the people that you can forget because you're not going to change their opinions anyway. They're zealots. Then
you have here two groups which often will be maybe 40% of the population on either side that are kind of leaning pro or leaning con. That's Vicki Nixon, Silent Majority, Joe and Jane Sixpack. And they'll give you an opinion. If you do some opinion research, they'll give you an opinion on that, but they're not ready to back up that opinion with behavior. Let me give you an example. 67% of the population of the United States, in study after study after study, favored the passage of ERA. In each of the states that finally sounded the death knell for ERA, a majority of the voting population favored it. Had it been put to referendum, it would have passed. And it didn't, by rather large numbers. Why? Because surveys will tell us what Joe and Jane think, but they won't include that active ingredient that they are unwilling to get up from the tube and the six pack to do anything about it. Therefore, we have left a number that often is only 10%, sometimes far less, of the total in the middle. These are the opinion leaders in society who are willing, who feel a responsibility, a social commitment to do something about an issue, or at least about many issues. And each subject will have its own set of opinion leaders on. Those are the people that we need to go after. Now, put yourself in my shoes. I represent the pacifists, okay? My client has some doubts as to whether we ought to build many more nuclear and hydrogen missile bombs. Not an unreasonable position, and so they want to try and persuade the whole public, if you will, at least the government, that that ought to be our posture, our policy. Now, traditionally in public relations, we would have started out willy-nilly to convince the public, you know, all 100% of them, and it should be obvious to us, we will never have the budget to do that, never. Tony DiLorenzo was a public relations director for about 30 years at General Motors. I've known him well for years, and he used to come to the annual PRSA conference. And he was a kind of a sour-looking guy anyway, and this was when GM, you know, before they got in trouble. He was kind of a sour-looking guy anyway, and if you'd ever talked to Tony, he had one theme that kept running through his mind. And that was, he would always say, I can't do this job. I cannot do this job. Because I only have a staff of 800 and a budget of 40 million, and they expect me to do this job. I can't do it. Well, if Tony can't tell everybody on GM with those kind of numbers, I have a hunch it ought to be a lesson to all of us that we should never even waste our time trying to go after all these folks. Instead, let's concentrate here because usually, if an issue has been around a while and been debated, but no decision has been made, that means that these opinion leaders are often divided something like 6% to 4%, that tells me something right off. Instead of trying to persuade 100%, forget it. I am going to focus my resources on persuading 3%. Because if I can change 6 to 4, to 4 to 6, that great arbiter, public opinion, has now shifted in my favor. But the question is, who are these guys and gals? And how can I find out? Well, there are a number of ways for doing this. And sociometric studies are one that we, in any form of public relations, should be very cognizant of and I think able to use. A sociometric study may be this simple. A few years ago, we were given the task in a northeastern state of passing a ballot referendum in a six-month campaign. There were 6 months left before the vote. And the last ballot referendum that had passed in that state took 41 years of constant work. And our client said, you know, you can probably pull this off in 6 months. So we looked at the problem
and decided that we had to find out who were the opinion leaders, the thought leaders, in that entire state. And this is what we did. First, of course, we segmented our publics because we know there is no general public. We segmented our publics into various leadership groups, and I won't bore you with the long list of publics we had. And then, in about 16 key communities throughout the state, which were different for each public, we talked to maybe 50 people in each of those communities, and we simply asked those people on subjects having to do with taxation, who are the people in town here, you know, that you really respect? I mean, never mind whether they're your friends or whether you like them or whether you even know them. Or maybe they are your friends or you like them or you know them. But either way, who are the three people that you really would listen to and perhaps be influenced by on this issue? And the names come back. And sure enough, when we sorted them out, we were able to make a pretty strong statement of who the opinion leaders were in that entire state by that relatively simple method. Needless to say, the person who rose to the top of the list, who was mentioned most often, became, with a little arm-twisting, the chairman of the campaign. The other people, wherever we could enlist them to the cause, became the leaders in their communities or their counties or whatever. In 6 months, the referendum passed by about a 75% vote, and frankly, we take no credit for that whatsoever. We simply knew how to go out and do a sociometric survey and find out who that already had the respect of their public was an opinion leader, and we simply plugged them in. I think if you will try this technique, you will be amazed, but in order to do it, you're going to need to know how to do sociometric surveys. Now, this is obviously a very random, a very loose kind of indicator. One could be terribly misled, but as professionals, we have judgment. And if we find that some of those folks that come up on the names turn out to be zealots, heaven forbid, clearly we will not use them very much. If we find that others are involved in a lot of competing issues, of course, we'll have the common sense to drop them. But sooner or later, to the top of that list will rise those folks who are listened to by others, the true beacons that we can use. There are a number of other methods for finding opinion leaders, but the sociometric survey is one that I have yet to find a superior method to, at least. Question? Go ahead. I'll repeat your question.
You say you can take no credit for the outcome of this particular referendum. Yet, couldn't you in some way subliminally prepare the people that you surveyed in the direction of the opinion leaders?
The question was, I had said that we could take no credit for that campaign. She doesn't realize that consultants never take credit, just money. And then she asked, didn't we subliminally prepare the public for the outcome of the campaign? Well, of course we did. Our goal was to change some behavior on this issue. We are professionals helping our clients advocate their positions in the court of public opinion, and certainly we did that. Let me just speak, if you have some interest, let me just speak for a minute about this whole question of public relations and its ability to prepare the public, if you will, to come to a conclusion. Some people get terribly worried about this, particularly in academic institutions. That's why we use these totally meaningless words like advancement. Now, I'd like to send each of you out on the street here and say to someone, I work for so-and-so university, I'm an advancement. See what kind of answer. Well, you know the problem. But that's why we rarely call it what it is, which is public relations, meaning relationships with our public. I have no qualms about using that term. That's why I use it liberally here. But I think sometimes the reason we use the euphemism is because we have this feeling that it's manipulative. You see, that we're going to do these awful things to people. The only thing I can say to anyone who has any lingering doubts about that is that you sure as hell underestimate people. I haven't met anybody yet that I could manipulate. I can't tell my six-year-old when to go to bed. So I have no fears of manipulation. The court of public opinion, the democratic process, has to be the most marvelous invention of mankind because it is an absolutely self-righting system.
As soon as we make a mistake, as I feel personally we did in 1980, we corrected in 1984. Therefore, I am not worried. It took you a while, didn't it? Kenny Kennedy's a client of mine. I have another Bible. Therefore, Yaphorn, you want to talk about Japaquiddick or black sexism and research. Therefore, I don't think we have to worry about that. Our goal is to try and find those people who can help sway the public, the opinion leaders, whomever, to the view that we espouse. Don't worry about it. There'll always be somebody on the other side. And if public relations consultants like our firm become more numerous, we will guarantee there is someone on the other side. Because if they weren't there to start with, we will form a movement group and attack your position. That is, however, I'm making light of this. But I wish I had the skills to mass psychoanalyze all of us here and all the other practitioners and see how many of us still have a hang-up about public relations in that way. If you do, think a little bit about the American people and how swayable they are. Not very. Let me just go on to another point here. One other thing that I have to say to you is beware of polling firms like mine. I mean, be very wary of us. You won't have to be awfully wary of mine, of course. The reason is that we don't believe in statistical calisthenics. We believe that research exists to get results with the dollars available. It's precision to make decisions. And we know that there aren't big budgets and that sometimes we have to do it in the shortcut method. But yet it has to be a trustworthy indicator, or as trustworthy as it can be, given the time available. The trouble with most polling firms is that you can't make any money doing that. So that even when it isn't necessary, they have to offer a beautiful printout. You know, we judge the results by the printout, right? The number of cross-references, the size of that computer paper. And therefore, I urge you to be wary of my colleagues in polling firms. Know enough about the research process to know indeed when you're dealing with an unknown universe and really need a statistical poll, and when indeed you can do it yourself. Well, we've got about 10 more minutes here, and I want to just present you with at least one specific piece that I think may be helpful to you as you leave. We have been concerned about the recruiting practices of most colleges and universities that we deal with. We find them wasteful, we find them untargeted, and we find that no one can really measure the effectiveness of them because our clients are demanding evidence. We've tried to put together a number of indicators that will let us have what we call a self-correcting research method for our recruitment work. By self-correcting, I mean a kind of a gyroscope. You know, it's the gyroscope that keeps that missile going toward the moon. It corrects it when it gets off course. Or maybe the example of a heat-seeking missile is better. It goes and just keeps following the target. Our problem is that in most universities, we start out doing something and we produce a particular phrase or slogan or find an audience and it looks pretty good, and we just keep working that mind until maybe long after the mind is worked out. So the questions are how to come up with a system that will be a self-correcting mechanism, a self-correcting recruiting effectiveness technique. And we have done that by trying to set up a continuing research process, which is easy to do because we know that you haven't got a lot of time for this, which will focus on the audiences, which will focus on the recruiting methods, which will focus on the documents or publications or themes that are being used, and then which will measure the effectiveness of those annually. You could do it semi-annually, but really there's not enough time for change. And because no research is worth a hoot unless other people believe it and will behave according to its suggestiveness. This is a participative process. This is not something that just the public relations people do or just the recruiters, but faculty and administrators are involved in this process by forming the team which in fact does the research. Generally, once the project is decided upon, we get faculty who are teaching research techniques to do the actual work, and they of course use it as classroom exercise. So that becomes something they like. It takes up several classes every year, gives some real experience to their students, and it's better than, you know, making up phony research projects about how many chocolate bars can we sell in Peoria. What we have tried to do with this system, and I can only give you the briefest outline, I suggest that you can set up a very similar system for fundraising, for alumni activities, for whatever. This one happens to be on recruiting. Here's the way we have looked at it, and this may give you some kind of a guide. First, in order to focus on the audience, we identify the potential recruits. And we ask that question as, this happens to be the sheet I've got here is taken from a state university. So we ask the question, how many high school graduates from within the state have chosen the state university? How many high school graduates in the state chose to go somewhere else? How many chose to go out of state? And we keep those statistics on a constant running basis so we know all the time how we're doing in those areas. On the other hand, how many people from out of state chose to come here? How many people came here from out of state and said, can it, and left and went somewhere else? And is there any way we could find out why? Then how many adult learners have chosen us? And how many really key people that we were trying to recruit, not athletes, scholars, came here, and how many didn't? And the list could be varied for your particular institution, but notice that at least we're getting down now to specifics, specific publics, and how they are behaving toward our institution. In provable numbers, because we're dealing with enrollments and non-enrollments. Having determined who they are, and therefore where our recruiting energy should go, because we know where we're succeeding and failing, then we ask the question, who are the recruiters? Are we indeed using all the human resources that we have available? For example, how are we dealing with parents, with peers, with teachers, counselors, and school principals? What materials, what themes, what information are we presenting to them? And is it the information that indeed the recruits want to hear, need to know? Or are we still giving them superfluous stuff? There's a good article, I think, in that issue of Case Currents I held up about the Southern University, it may have been Alabama, no, it was Mississippi, and how they had found that they hadn't kept up. They were still presenting a kind of a swinging, let's live it up, brochure and catalog and a letter to students who were saying, how am I going to get a job? If you haven't read that article, I urge you to read it. It shows how some research enabled them to change. In addition to those recruiters, a group that many times we forget about, don't do as much with as we should, then we begin to identify the alumni, the faculty, the other students, and of course, those of us who have formal responsibilities for getting recruiting done, admissions or recruiting officers. Having identified those two and now starting to put them together in a specific way, we then begin asking such questions as the resources that we're using. Like the recruiting message itself, the subject, the content, the layout, the format, the visuals, the saleables. Are we applying what we know about persuasion? Or are we, in fact, writing an academic document? when it should be some kind of a persuasive piece. Finally, we asked about that simple question of how. How are we going about all of this? Who has what assignments? Are we using too much print material? Have we found a way to plug in audio visuals? And most important, have we followed what we know to be the two-step flow of persuasive information by following up any impersonal materials like audio visuals or letters or catalogs with some kind of a personal visitation? That's an area where many of us have gotten very skilled. The teacher call, the student visit, all of those things. What we find missing is putting all of those together in a standard, simple format that recurs year after year after year so that it becomes self-targeting. The first year that we used a system like this, the need in this particular state university was to convince more in-state students that this was a quality place that they should choose, and our target was right over here. And knowing that, we were able to line up recruiters, resources, and a how system to focus on those in-state students. Amazingly, in a couple of years, through this activity, we were getting about all the in-state students that rationality told us we were going to get. There is a certain kind of a natural cutoff percentage, and certainly there's a limit to the number of in-state students maybe that a state institution ought to have. We need a mix of out-of-staters. So this system, at the end of that very year, told us we don't need that anymore. We need to change our materials. We need to change our how. We need to change our recruiters in order to go over here after out-of-state students. I suggest if we had not had this system, we would probably still be recruiting in-state students and wondering why our numbers were down. Well, that's just one example. If you're interested, by the way, we're refining that system. If you're interested in that at all, drop me a note and I will try at some point in the near future to send you the results of our latest work on it, and maybe it's something you can borrow from. Well, I hope that in this time we've had together that I've shown you at least a smattering of the research techniques that are available to us and that we can know and use. I want to leave you with thoughts of the research director for Honeywell. She's the public relations research director for the Honeywell Corporation. And here's a statement she made that I think sets the tone of what I'm trying to say. She says, "No other profession takes as much for granted as we in public relations do." What she's saying, of course, is we don't get out there and get the evidence. And then she points out, "A trial lawyer would be out of practice in a year if his or her work were based only on assumptions. And I hate to think what would happen to a doctor." On that note, I will urge you to go home and do a hell of a lot more research. Thanks for listening.
That was excellent. You said you should write to you. Where do we write to you?
Let me give you my card. Oh, hell,
I
didn't bring them this morning.
Well, Patrick Jackson,
Box J, Epping, EPPING, New Hampshire.
New Hampshire, huh?
Yeah, 03042.
Oh, whereabouts in Hampshire is that?
03042. It's right next to Exeter.
0042. Right next to Exeter?
Yeah. Okay, we moved up there from New York about 20 years ago and loved it.
You mentioned, I come from Lowell, Mass, so I know the area. You mentioned the Fox test. What was the other test you mentioned?
Flesch, F-L-E-S-C-H. That's Rudolph.
Oh, Rudolph Flesch. Yeah, right. Okay, thank you.
Right on.
Thank you very much.
What's that address? Is that
in your car? No, it's not in there. I'm sorry. I should have written it up there. It's, yes. Is it? Oh, for heaven's sake. Yeah, where is he?
He's in Ford Hospital.
In Ford? Oh, I will send him a note. Right? I mean, he's not in imminent danger? Or?
No, but it's a very serious heart attack.
And his daughter's a friend of mine also, working
on it.
Well, she left Killanova now. She's taken on the job of the Vice President for Public Relations, probably way over her head at International Harvester, the basket case among American corporations.
Oh, you should send him a note.
I will. Thank you very much for telling me.
Box J, you said?
Box J. My address is Box J, Epping, E-P-P-I-N-G.
He's going to another social area.
New Hampshire.
I mean, he's going to be...
03042.
What a
So you're not Boston based?
No, we moved up there from New York about 20 years ago, and find we get about twice as much work done.
You going to be around here?
Yes, I'll be here through Thursday.
Great job, really.
Thank you very much.
Oh, okay.
How do you rationalize, I agree with you, relating fundraising to public relations and not, you know, everybody else divides it. You put fundraising right into the public relations.
Well, I am now, Nancy Raley is now pushing me very hard to finish my article for Case Currents on why development must report to public relations or we're all in deep trouble.
That's right, and I think it's right, but it's something that's not been said enough. It's whispered.
Right, well, I'm saying it right out loud in Case Currents.
Two things. Number one, where can you read more about the Delphi process?
Delphi process. The Rand Corporation developed this in 1964 and has a book called The Delphi Process, R-A-N-D, you know, the Rand Corporation. And the best modern book about it is a book by Harrell, H-A-R-R-E-L-L, Allen, A-L-L-E-N, called Techniques in Social Sciences. And he in there gives a lot of techniques, one of which is Delphi. He is one of the reigning experts, Hal Allen.
Simply for your information, maybe you know this already, Bell Labs, with their system called Unix for Computers,
yes,
has put three of these readability quotients into a program, so I can sit at my terminal now and write something and do something called style,
yes,
and it'll print out exactly what the readability quotients are and all this information. It's terrific.
Isn't that terrific? Yeah. And then if you punch it again, of course, it'll erase all the words that don't make it. And Bell's own system, they don't sell that yet. But that's the way they're training their people. Then it comes up with a whole lot of asterisks for the word that didn't make it. So you know where to plug in the new word.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Jackson, thank you very much. It was really great.
Good to see you, Rosetta.
You've done, I assume, many alumni surveys.
Oh, yes.
Places.
Oh, yes.
Okay, we'll be in touch.
Good.
That's the group that we still don't work with them enough. We don't plug them in enough. I guess you could never do enough work with alumni. If we could ever really show them that education is lifelong, keep them being educated all their lives and really getting behind it, the American public would believe in higher education. And we've never learned to do that despite our best efforts.
In my opinion.
Lots of.
What do you think of measure the effectiveness of a news operation by statistical gathering of, comparing not only, say, column inches, but trying to come up with dollar values?
It's useless. If you hand in column inches, you make yourself a slave.
Exactly.
And so,
is there any measure?
Yeah, we do a public relations audit. We start out with some benchmarks. The first is to this is how people are responding to this.
On attitude.
Attitude or information. A lot of times information is the best test. Never mind how their emotions have entered into it. Have they got the message that we have a school of medicine, that we have a general college, whatever? You and I know if we went out in the streets and asked even educated people about Boston institutions, they don't know that. Why should they? It's our job to tell them. And that's the best way that we know. Because, boy, if you do it by column inches, hell, that's no measure. The best year you ever had, and you may get the fewest.
That's right.
So, would you believe? No, my cards are up in my room somewhere. If you want to write me for that thing, I can give you my address. It's Box J for Jackson, Epping, E-P-P-I-N-G, New Hampshire, 03042. I think our firm gets more mail than anybody in our little town, so it'll probably get to me if you just remember Epping.
Dick Strunk, back, Quan City's PRC chapter,
yes,
super
of
job.
Yes, thought you looked
good to have you with us. Two
good
points.
To be here.
I think, Bruce, this is very much on target. Because we're in education, this is of necessity an interdisciplinary function.
Of course.
Too many people are not combining their programs with their marketing faculty, their social science research people, and others, and I think this is better. Secondly, institutional leadership is in-house. It's a ingrown Tony Hawk concept. They are not recognizing that disciplines other than educational PhDs, in that area have something to say in higher education.
They're not looking to business,
the marketing skills. Phil Kotler has not been accepted in many ways.
Never will.
The reason
I keep getting asked back to Case, I think this is about the 12th or 13th time I've spoken to Case, is because the first time I came to talk, I talked about how our presidents themselves are doomed to failure and doom our institutions to failure.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a standing ovation on that.
Very good. I think it's another message for us.
Amen.
Who speaks for higher education? It's not always the doctor.
Exactly. Well, that's the one argument I still have with Case.
Exactly.
Is where the hell were we on Capitol Hill? Don't tell me about 3 weeks after the bill was out. I mean the next day. You know, and Jesus, I think a lot of people are afraid to speak up. They don't understand the court of public opinion. That in America, you not only have the right, but the responsibility to contribute to public debate. Otherwise, if it goes against you, don't bitch.
Right.
You did it. You and I are in sync on that one.
Okay, good.
Good to see you again.
Thanks very much.
You bet.
Mm-hmm.